So we're on Daf Chaf Hey Omid Aleph.
No, go, thanks.
Yeah, and we're on the bottom of the Daf. You'll see two lines before the end of the Daf with the two dots. And the Gemara quotes the Mishnah. And the Mishnah says, Mesu Baleem Ajlo Shasu. So we have here a machlokes in our Mishnah between Beis Hillel and Beit Shammai. And let's just take a minute to summarize our conclusion of yesterday. The conclusion of yesterday is that a Baal could be mochel on his kinui, but only before stira. After stira, it's too late, and it's irrevocable. But now we're going to discuss the following case. The husband Nebuch, as we say in Yiddish, as gestorben, he died before she got to drink from the bitter waters.
But after stira.
What do you say?
After,
right, everything was set, we were ready for her to drink, and Nebuch
he dies.
And here we have a machlokas between Beis Hillel and Beit Shammai about the ksuba. If you remember, the rules of the game were as follows. If she is responsible for the fact that she doesn't drink, then she has no rights to the ksuba. If he's responsible for the fact that she doesn't drink, then she gets her ksuba. The middle of the road case, which is sort of the twilight zone, you don't know exactly how to define it and classify it, is where he dies. You know, if he made a decision that he doesn't want her to drink, that's his fault, so to speak. He's the gorem, and she has rights to ksuba. If, on the other hand, she made that decision, you know, for whatever reason, she did what she did, and therefore she doesn't drink from the mei merorim, in such a case, she forfeits ksuba. What about in the case where he dies? So let's go through the two shitos. Beit Shammai is of the opinion that although she doesn't drink from the mei merorim, that's no fault of her own, and therefore she collects her ksuba. Now again, the husband is dead, so she can't sue him for the ksuba, but she sues the yarshim, the heirs, and that's called the estate. So she can force the other heirs, let's say he has children, so forth and so on, to pay up the ksuba. And as we said a million times over, the ksuba is a very substantial sum of money. Beis Hillel, on the other hand, says she forfeits the ksuba. And the Gemara now asks, b'maika miflugli, means what's the yesod of the machlokas? What is the fundamental issue here? And we're going to see here a major issue between Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel that has repercussions way, way beyond Masechta Sota. And it touches on the issue of Hamotzi Mechavero Olaf Araya. Can anybody here tell me what that means? Hamotzi Mechavero Olaf Araya. Don't all answer at once, I can't hear so many voices.
I want to once again guess and prove it. He had to get it out for the
community. In English it's called possession is 9/10 of the law. I mean, the halacha doesn't exactly formulate that. But it means the burden of proof is always on the plaintiff who's trying to sue for payment, whether it's a case of loans, whether it's a case of compensation for damages, whatever the case may be. It's always obligatory on the person who wants to get money out of someone else that he adduce the proof. That's called hamotzi. Hamotzi means the one who's trying to get it out. Motzi, to get it out. Michavero, from his friend. Olav, upon him, the motzi. Haraya, the burden of proof. Now, we have a situation here of what's called a shtar. A shtar means that we're talking about a document. A document which testifies to someone's obligation. Now again, that obligation could be conditional, but if the condition is met, then the shtar, in the hands of the balashtar, the hands of the person who owns the shtar, he's the one who wants to collect with that shtar. For example, in the case of a lender and a borrower, who would be holding on to the shtar? Jeremy, who would be holding on to the shtar in the case of a borrower and a lender, malv and a loaf?
The lender.
The lender, correct. That's the Malva. Why? Because he's the Baal HaShtar. The Shtar testifies on his behalf that he can collect the funds that are testified by the Eidim signed in the Shtar from the Lov. Okay, Jeremy, now I'm going to press even further. In the case of the Ksuba, who holds on? Who's the Baal HaShtar?
The husband is.
Oh. Again, I asked Jeremy. The reason I didn't ask you, Marvin, is because I want to get the right answer. That's why I asked Jeremy.
The wife.
Why? Because with that ksuba, if one of two conditions are met, she collects. Yeah. She's like the malve. In effect, he owes, O-W-E, right, owes a chov. Again, it's a conditional chov, and the condition is met in one of the following two circumstances, namely, either he what? Divorces her, or he dies. I feel like a dentist here. It's like pulling teeth. I don't know, I didn't go to dental school. Okay, so if one of the following two conditions come to existence, to fruition, either he divorces her, or alternatively, he dies, then the ksuba in her hands, because she's the Baal HaShtar, is a weighty evidence. It's almost like, you know, at that point, let's say he dies, she could sell the ksuba. The ksuba is worth 200 zuz if it was a first marriage. She could sell it for, I wouldn't say 200, maybe she'd get 199, because, you know, who wants to go through the hassle of collecting the ksuba, but it's basically worth full value, you know what I mean? It's maturity value, because he died. Now again, she's going to collect the ksuba from whom, everybody? He's dead already. You know, you can't collect money from a dead body. That's not allowed. From the heirs. Excellent. H-E-I-R-S, right? From the heirs of the estate. And she has the ksuba.
Okay, can I just...
Just 1 second. You can't ask me any questions because I'm not ready for any questions. I just have to get the mathematics first. As soon as I get the mathematics, the floor is yours, Alan. But let me just get the mathematics. So what happens now? The ksuba is in the hands of the Isha, right? She is the Baal HaShtar. Let's say a question would come up about the shtar. There's somebody out there, probably the Baal, if he's alive, who's claiming that this ksuba is invalid for whatever reason. Who would have the burden of proof?
She.
No, he.
It's very complicated on both sides. This is the machlokes between the great giants of all time, Beis Hillel and Beit Shammai. They debated this for years and years. Listen carefully. On the one hand, she's trying to collect money. Mm-hmm. That means the burden of proof is on her. That's called Hamotzi, Michavero, Olav Araya. On the other hand, she's holding on to a shtar. And that document in her hands, which is called a ketubah, or a ksuba in Ashkenazi, gives her the ability to collect that chov. She doesn't need anybody's okay, anyone's haskama. She has two witnesses that are signed in the shtar. The shtar is valid. There's no one, you know, there's no counterfeit on the shtar. And in that case, she's in the driver's seat. If he comes along, or the Arshim, if after his death, and they claim, well, you know what? I have a problem with this ksuba. I don't think it's valid. Well, the burden of proof is on you to invalidate the ksuba. But wait a second. She's the one who's suing me, let's say I'm an heir, or if the Baal after the divorce, for the ksuba. I'll give you an example. Let's say a man would throw a get to his wife, and it's a suffix. We don't know if the get is valid or not valid. She comes along and she wants to collect her ksuba. So he's going to say to her, well, the get... I'm sorry, I just get distracted. So she's going to say that the get is a valid get, and if I have rights to my ksuba, he's going to say, well, the get is not valid, and I don't have to pay you the ksuba. So again, we're going to have this whole debate as to who has the burden of proof. Now we have a case of a woman who doesn't drink from Meimararim. Mm-hmm. All the pieces of the puzzle were there except for one problem. Erz Gishtarvin. And if he dies before the Ashkar, she doesn't have the Meimararim. She can't prove her innocence. So we don't know. How do we define this? It's really complicated, because on the one hand... you know, he wasn't guilty. I mean, it wasn't a suicide case. And on the other hand, she wasn't guilty because she didn't. It wasn't a murder case. It was neither suicide nor murder. So Nebuch, the guy died. You know, it happens. People die. I mean, we're not. You know, we hope for the day when death will be defeated. But in the meantime, death is part of the reality of life. So we don't know what the status of the ksuba is. So now we have to analyze it. Do we consider her to be the muhsak? She's in the driver's seat because the heirs in this case, they have to prove that she lost and forfeited her rights to the ksuba. Or should we say no? They're in the driver's seat because they're heirs. They clearly inherit the father's estate. And now she wants to collect from that estate. Well, I'm otzi mechavel of araya. So how do you define this? And this is going to be a machlokes between Beis Hillel Beit Shammai that's going to reverberate through the generations because it's going to be relevant to every single case where there's an issue about a shtar. We don't know if the shtar in the hands of the Baal Shtar is valid or not valid. Somebody wants to claim, it's probably the defendant, that the shtar is not valid. Well, the burden of proof is on you to invalidate the shtar. No! You're the one who wants to collect for this. So you have to prove it. You know, so on the one hand, you know, the Baal Shtar is considered a mukhsa because he's got a valid shtar. On the other hand, the other person has a right to say to the Baal Shtar, you prove that your shtar is a valid shtar. Because if there's any question on the shtar, the validity of the shtar, well, now you're coming to collect from me with the shtar. So the lover says to the malva, you know what? I already paid you back. Forget about that shtar. The shtar is invalid. The malva says, no, you didn't pay me back. The shtar is valid. Who has the burden of proof? Well, the lover has a right to say to the malva, you want to collect this chov from me? You have the burden of proof. Come to Beis Din and prove that your shtar is valid. The malva has a right to say to the lover, I have a shtar. You want to disprove my shtar? Then your burden of proof is on you to disqualify my shtar. Mm-hmm. And this is going to be a machlokas between Beis Hillel and Beit Shammai. Alan, I'm going to give you the floor in just one more minute. Beit Shammai Savri, Beit Shammai of the opinion, shtar ha-omed ligvos ki-gavui dami. You have to underline those words, ki-gavui dami. What it means is that if you are holding on to a shtar, the shtar is good for its money, and it's omed ligvos. All that we're waiting for is gvira, you know, just to implement the power that's invested in the shtar to collect the money. Right? Gvira means collection. You're gonna have to write that down. Gvira means collection. And kigavui dom. It's money in the bank. A shtar is money in the bank, says Beit Shammai. It's kigavui dom. For all intents and purposes, it's as if you've already collected that chov. What do you mean you collected the chov? You didn't collect the chov. Well, the answer is because the shtar is omed ligvos. You know, it reminds me of bonds. I don't know, in every country is a little different, but you know, you buy a bond, right? So when you buy a bond, the government owes you money. Now you can collect that money today. You'll get a fraction of what it's worth, or you can collect it at maturity value, or anywhere in between, correct? But whatever the value of the bond is set, you know, they have these timelines, you know, on that day, if you cash in the bond, you'll be able to get that amount of money. So Beit Shammai says, kigavui dami. Well, what's the bond worth? You know, you might say, well, the bond is just a piece of paper. It's basically a promissory note from the government, and it's worth a couple of pennies, you know, you could use it as a bottle cap. But the answer is no, because since you have rights to collect with this shtar, you can even sell it on the open market. It says Beit Shammai, that's kigavui dami. It's as if the money is in your bank account. No, now comes the Baal or his Yorshim and says, no, she was a sota. And even though she can't drink and prove her innocence, she forfeits her ksuba. And she says, no, I didn't forfeit my ksuba. I was ready to drink and prove my innocence. And you died? You know, the Baal Nebuchadnezzar died? That's not my issue. And I'm holding on to a ksuba. I want to collect that ksuba. Says Beit Shammai, that ksuba is like money in the bank. Anyone who comes forward, you know, the very fancy lawyer on behalf of the estate, on behalf of the Yorshim, comes along and he wants to claim that this shtar is not a valid shtar. The ksuba cannot be collectible because she never drank and proved her innocence. Well, Well, says Beit Shammai, the burden of proof is on you. You have to prove that she forfeits her ksuba. Because if you don't, then the shtar ha'omed ligvos ke'er gavui dami. It's already money in the bank. That's how we view the shtar. And now Rabbosai turn to daf chof hey omed beis ubeis hillel savri. Shtar ha'omed ligvos lav ke gavui dami. We don't define the shtar as if it was already money collected in the bank. And therefore, if she wants to use this shtar ksuba to collect her ksuba, then in any case of doubt, the burden of proof is on her. In this case, unfortunately, she cannot prove her innocence because since the Baal died, there's no possibility of her drinking from the Meimararim. And therefore, she is in a bind because she wants to get the heirs to cough up the money, to cough up the property. And she doesn't have ample proof to do so because we cannot allow her to avail herself of the opportunity of drinking from the Meimararim. So again, let's go over it one more time. According to Beit Shammai, shtar omed ligvos ke gavui dami. Who's considered the one who's in possession here? Is she? Is because she's holding on to what? To the shtar ksuba. And the shtar ksuba is like money in the bank. It's already collected. And Beis Hillel say no. Shtar omed ligvos lav ke gavui dami. It's not as if she collected it. And this is a loan and a lien and so forth and so on, but it's not money in the bank. And therefore, if there's any doubt as to whether she has rights to collect the ksuba, the burden of proof is on her. And if she can't prove her innocence, then she has to forfeit her ksuba. That's Beis Hillel. And Rabbosai, in this context, we really could introduce a whole discussion about something called shibud. I'm not sure if you're familiar with this word. Shibud. In English, it's called L-I-E-N. Did I write that correctly?
A lien.
In Hebrew, in the language of the Torah, it's called a shibud.
Shibud.
Shi'abud is the way the Sfarad name would pronounce. You have to pronounce the I, especially if you're a Yemenite. Shi'abud. So what is a shi'abud? A shi'abud means that all of the husband's possessions, he's the lova in this case, right, because he owes the ksuba, all of his possessions are leaned to pay up the ksuba. So for example, it's fascinating, if the Baal owns a piece of property of real estate, and during the course of the marriage he sells it, if he cannot pay the ksuba, she has rights, you know, this is like a default rights, to go ahead and collect that money from the hands of the buyers who purchased the real estate from the husband. And that's called a lien. Again, there are certain conditions. You know, the buyer has to be aware of the fact when he purchased it that there's a lien on it. And that's called a shtar. A shtar has the what's called a kol. In other words, today everything's registered in the computer system of the municipality or whatever. But in those days, they didn't have such sophisticated, you know, registration. It was a shtar. A shtar is considered registered. Everybody knows about a shtar. The Aiden sign in the shtar, and it's well known public information. So you went ahead, you bought this piece of karka from a man. The man is married. You have to realize that if he defaults on the payment of the ksuba, let's say he divorces his wife, or if he dies and the Yorshim don't have enough money to pay the ksuba, you as a buyer are now responsible to pay up that chov. Why? Because you purchased the piece of property that has what on it? A shi'abud. Are you following me? Now again, this would almost clinch who's shita. Who should be right now? Exactly, Beit Shammai should be right. Why? Because Beit Shammai is saying shtar omid ligvos kigavui dami. You know, so I'm only missing that last step of collection, but I have that. You know, if that karka is worth the ksuba is 200 zuz, that karka is worth 200 zuz, basically she has the karka. She has it in her back pocket, so to speak. I mean that figuratively, because karka, you can't put it into your back pocket. But it's in our bank. And that's kigavui dami. And it's fascinating, because the Gemara in Pesachim says the following, listen carefully, that if the malva, right, the malva, that's the isha in our case of ksuba, if the malva collects chametz, like let's say for example, you had a very expensive piece of chametz, like a whiskey, a house of whiskey, I'm talking about chametz stick of whiskey that could be worth a lot of money, and the Malva collects that chametz after Pesach for a loan that took place before Pesach, then since it was leaned on behalf of the Malva, he violates retroactively Bal Yerov, Bal Yematzeh. You're not allowed to own chametz on Pesach. Well, he's saying, I didn't own it on Pesach, but it doesn't matter. Because since you collected it, your collection was already clinched at the time of the chov, at the time of the outstanding loan. I mean, all that seems to support Beit Shammai. I'm just giving you a taste of how far the repercussions here of Beit Shammai's principle. And Beis Hillel says, no, a shtar is a chov. Go prove that your shtar is a valid shtar. And the burden of proof is on you. You're collecting that chov. Is a motzi mechavel of a raya. Alan, I'm sorry, I postponed you a little bit too long, and I apologize for that, but I just had to get the mathematics.
I think I'm a bit punch drunk. In
L'chaim. Can you make a L'chaim on Vasa? I doubt it. But
in
you make a L'chaim on anything.
When they are regarding these cases,
I see you're not a Hasidic Yid. I mean, if I told my Shver, that I'm making a lechaim on water, he would throw me out. We don't make a lechaim on water.
It's the same bracha.
Okay. How intricate were wills in those days? Was it the Bechor and the children, or were wills actually written out, and were there...
The Gemara is full of discussions about wills and so forth. Do you know that Rabbi Yehuda Anasi, the author of the Mishnah, he left a will? And the Gemara tells us exactly what it says in the will.
Sure.
Not just giving you one example, but there are many examples. But in the case of a ksuba, there's no need for a will. Why? Because the ksuba is a shtar chov, and a shtar chov is collectible from the possessions of the person who owes that chov. So she has a shtar chov against her husband, which is called a ksuba. And if he dies, then that's collectible from the Yorshim. I don't need a will for that, because again, once that chov was engendered, then it's collectible, and you don't need a will for that. Okay, Rabbi, we're on now Daf Chaf Hei Amid Beis. Does everybody have the place? We're up to the second line on Chaf Hei Amid Beis Meuberes. Now you're going to have to stay a little longer today, because we want to finish all the Tosafot on this page. So you'll probably be here for about 2 months. I'm just joking. I'm trying to scare you. It's a scare pack. Okay. Now the Mishnah speaks about a number of cases here in which the husband cannot... we'll give a list of three or four possible reasons. The husband could not propagate, meaning he cannot have a child from this woman. So let's mention a few possibilities. One possibility is called an ilanus, which is a Greek word. An ilanus, ilo, this is vav. And an ilanus is a woman who from birth has a defect. And she's a female, but not totally a female, meaning she cannot propagate. The simonim that usually indicate that a woman matures, that they're down here and up here, different simonim, she doesn't have any of the simonim. And she doesn't develop them biologically. She's called an islandess. Then you have another case of a woman who cannot produce children, and that's because of some sort of accident. You know, she had a disease or some sort of an accident, and the physicians have determined that she can no longer bear children. And then you have a third case, which we're going to get to, and that's called menopause, which means that a woman is past the age of childbearing.
Yeah.
And in all these cases, we're going to have... Well, I'm going to say it like the Havamim in the Gemara. We're going to backtrack a little bit later. But in all these cases, we have a gigantic machlokes in our Mishnah between the Tanakama and Rabbi Eliezer. Is she excluded from drinking the bitter waters, the Meimarorim, or is she included in Sota? Now watch what goes on here. Until this point in our analysis of the Mishnah, we were speaking about marriages that were somewhat faulty. You know, they were illegitimate. Like, for example, a man marries a mamzeres, and he's not allowed to be married to her. And the Torah requires that he divorce her. and in that case, she's excluded from Meimororin. Here we're talking about a man who's married to a woman, and the halacha would allow him to marry her, to be married to this woman. Or maybe not. Let's explain. In a case where a man is obligated to procreate, that's called the mitzvah of what, everybody?
Puravu.
So it's a very high-powered mitzvah. We don't really take it as seriously as we should. I mean, I have to tell you this, in the Haredi world, they take it very seriously. Very seriously. Way beyond you and I can't even imagine. You know, most of our families are complaining if they have more than 4 children or 5 children. I mean, you're talking about, I have a friend whose wife, this is 20 years ago, gave birth to her 21st child. No twins. Okay? He's married off, I think I went to the last wedding, I think it was number 16. He skipped a few in the middle there, but alright, they're still on the market. But, you know, this is the mitzvah piravu. I mean, the Gemara tells us in Masechta Baba Basra, you could sell a Sefer Torah for the mitzvah piravu rivya. The Gemara says that for the mitzvah piravu rivya, you can collect stock up very high on the priority list. I mean, piravu rivya is a big, big deal. It's called a mitzvah rabba in Shas, a great mitzvah. So it's not just coincidentally the first mitzvah in the Torah, it's one of the heaviest mitzvahs in the Torah. So the Chachamim are nervous about the following scenario. A man is married to a woman, he's obligated to procreate, and he cannot procreate. So technically, according to the halacha, he has to divorce her and marry a woman who could have children. Again, I'm not going into 1,001 questions and details, but just to get the general concept here. So therefore, to some extent, this marriage is illegitimate. It's not the same as what we spoke about until now. Meaning, up front, there was nothing, you know, non-kosher about the marriage, but as time developed, again, the islandist case is a little bit more complicated if you have, you know, because she was never, but as time developed and situations changed with the passage of time and some unfortunate event, she no longer became, she was no longer a childbearing woman. I meant to shut this off, I apologize. Oh, it is off. Okay. Anyway, so that a situation arose in which we may have to force him to divorce his wife. Now I say may have to divorce him, because here we have the sheet of Rabbi Lozer. Rabbi Lozer in our Mishnah says the following. You know what? This woman is included in the parsha of Meimororin. We're not going to force him to divorce his wife. What are we going to tell him to do? Marry a second wife. Now for most of us, I don't know, I don't want to speak on your behalf. One is
good enough.
One is, you know, maybe even more than enough. You're saying. Okay, you can't crack these jokes anymore. These are jokes that used to crack in, you know, my father's generation. But in any event, so that one is enough. But according to the Torah, you can marry more than one woman. So in effect, we don't have to, says Rabbi Lozer, we don't have to push the, you know, we don't have to push the Baal to divorce this wife. We have to push him to marry another wife. And the Chachamim say, well, in the meantime, he doesn't have another wife. And in the meantime, as far as this relationship is concerned with this wife, who's barren and is not childbearing, that's not really the marriage that he should be involved in, because he has to fulfill the mitzvah piravurim. So here we have l'chora, what would be a three-pronged machlokas. In all the three cases that we gave, the Chacham are going to say, well, the Torah does not recognize the legitimacy of continuing this marriage, right? Even though it was a perfectly kosher, legitimate marriage from the get-go. But now, because things have changed, it became a problematic marriage, and therefore the Chachamim say in these three cases she does not drink from the Meimororin. And for all intents and purposes, the Chachamim equate this with a case of a man who's married to a Mamzeris and he's not allowed to be married to her, because we want to force the divorce. Rabbi Lozer says no. In all these three cases, the marriage is legitimate. It started legitimate, and we're going to let it continue. We don't have to force the envelope here on a divorce. Let him marry another woman. But as far as this marriage is concerned, this marriage will go on, and therefore it's a regular, classic marriage, and it requires the drinking from the mace soto.
Yeah, I'm an islandist,
except for islandists. Islandists is going to be, Omer Rav Nachman, Omer Rabba Baravua, Machlokes, the Akora Uskena. The opinion of Rabbi Lozer only applies to these two cases of Akora and Zekena, a woman who became barren at some point, or she got old and she can no longer have children. Aval Islandis, in the case of Islandis, everybody has to agree that we now see clearly that from the get-go, this marriage did not lend itself to bearing children. So again, the Chachamim are going to say, well, the marriage initially was healthy, right? So let's say, for example, she became old, or Nebuchadnezzar, she had some sort of an incident, and she became a barren woman. So the Rabbanim say that, you know, there's a healthy marriage in its foundations, and therefore she should drink from the Mei Maror. But what about the case of an islandess? In the case of an islandess, this marriage never lent itself to having children. Oh, in this case, even the Chachamim will have to agree that she does not drink from the Mei Maror. Why? Shenemar, the Pasuk says in the Parasha Noso of Sota, and again, if we had time, we would go through the Pesukim inside. It says, V'niksav in Yisra'ah Zera. Now again, that part of the Parasha, which is at the very end of the story of Sota, really reflects on the great blessing that she will experience as a result of proving her innocence if and when she drinks from the Meimorim and she survives the test. But nevertheless, the Gemara sees in this Pasuk, and especially there's a double language here, V'nizra'ah Zera, a gilui, a revelation about the entire Parasha. And the entire Parasha says that who will drink from the Mei Marorim? Misha Darko Lazria. If she could have children. That's called Darko. She's, you know, if everything goes well and there's intimacy and so forth, she can become pregnant and have children. Yotze Zazu, to the exclusion of an islandess, she's not included in this description of Darko Lazria, Shein Darko Lazria, and therefore, since she cannot bear seed, the Chachamim will have to agree that she cannot drink from the Mei Marim. And again, you can't blame him for that, and she violated Kinui with Stira, and therefore she loses her Ksuba as well. So now we're reducing the Machlokas between Rabbi Lozer and Chachamim to two cases, where initially we thought it was a threefold machlokas. We're taking one of those three cases out of the bag, and there's no machlokas about the situation of what? Of an islandess, because everybody agrees to, in case of an islandess, that this marriage was doomed to failure, so to speak. When I say failure, I mean as far as Darko Lazria, just give me a minute, from the get-go. There was never a possibility in this marriage of fulfilling Darko Lazria, so this marriage doesn't lend itself to Darko Lazria. And since it doesn't lend itself to Darko Lazria, one of the basic conditions now in the parasha of Sota cannot be fulfilled, and therefore even the Chacham would have to agree that in this case of an islandess, she doesn't drink for the Mei Maror. Where is the argument? Where is the machlokas? That's going to be in two cases. Case of a woman who became barren, that's called an akora. And number two, case number two is a case of a zekena, because of her elderly age, she cannot have children. In those cases, the Chachamim say, wait a minute, the marriage is perfectly legitimate. And it was a marriage that lent itself to Darko Lazria. So we go back to the original Ishus, the original marriage bond at the time of Kedushin, and we say, well, it was a perfectly, you know, appropriate marriage for this pasuk of Darko Lazria, and therefore the Parsha of Sota applies. Now, she became, you know, she became an akara or a zekena, that's already the passage of time. That's not indicative of the issues of the original bond of issues, and therefore she's included, according to the Chachamim, in the pasuk of V'nizra Zera. Comes along Rabbi Elazar, and he says, wait a minute, you know what? In those two cases, I have to wonder. So the Chacham and Rabbi Lozer are at loggerheads about a case of a woman who, by the time we get to what? Tashka Sota, she's already excluded from the Nizra Zera. Do you follow me? In other words, the original marriage was such that she was perfectly capable of bearing children. With the passage of time, she lost her ability to bear children. So when we get to the Tashka Sota, what do we say? Should we say that we can give her a drink from the Mei Marorim or not? And here we have machlokas between the Tanakama and Rabbi Lazar. Rabbi Lazar says that what? That since the original marriage lent itself to Vinizra Zera, so she was included. I may have said it the other way around before. I'm sorry, I got the names mixed up. I don't remember what I said. But anyway, according to Rabbi Lazar, since she was included originally in the marriage of what? Of Vinizra Zera, then that already freezes the frame, and she's included in the parish of Sota. She will drink. However, Rabbi Loz is going to agree that in the case of an islandess, where from the get-go she was not a child-bearing woman, and therefore she was never in this marriage included in what? In Vinizra Zera, therefore there's no Ashkas Sota. The Rabbanan say that we're going to exclude Ashkas Sota in all three cases. Why? Because at the moment of Ashkas Sota, she's no longer in the description of an Isra Zera, and therefore there's no Ashkas Sot. Vesve, let's take a look at the following. The Braisa tells us, Hamakane Larusaso Ulishobers Yovan Shalo, a man gets kinui to an Arusa. Right, so this is before Nisuin, as we discussed at great length a week ago. Well, Shomer Siyavim means her husband died without leaving any children, and she falls for Yidin to his brother. And now the Yavam gives her what's called kinui, and he wants her not to go into stira with a certain man, is ad shelo kansa nistira. If before the marriage was clinched, was completed, meaning in the case of an Eirusin before Nisuin, in the case of a Shomer Siyavim before Yibum, is in this case, if before the marriage reached its fruition, she already violated the kinui, lo shosav lo notelos ksuba. Why? Because we said that the pasuk says a tachas isha, if you remember, and it has to be a full marriage, a complete ishus. And these two cases, it's not a complete ishus. The arus is not a complete ishus because we're lacking nisuin. And in the case of Yavama, it's not a complete ishus because there's only what we call zika, but there's no yib. So in all those cases, the stira would not generate a din of shisia. Again, it's still a violation of his kidui, and she forfeits her rights to ksuba because she had no justification for the stira. And now Rabosa, we turn to page Chaf Vav Amid Al. And we're continuing in the Brisa. The Brisa continues, it says, Me'uberes Umeinekes Atzma. Okay. O Shosa O Lonotels Ksuba Ksubasa. Right, so we're talking now. I'm sorry, did I skip something? I'm sorry, I think I skipped something. Where are we up to here? Muberes Chavero. I'm sorry, I skipped Muberes Chavero. Umeinekes Chavero. Oh, so here's a case where we have Machlokes Tanoim, whether this woman is included in the parasha of Hashkas Sota. What's the case? What are these two cases? These two cases are illegitimate marriages, but they're not illegitimate in a permanent way. What do I mean? It's only a temporary iser between him and her. Again, if you would ask me, I had no right to marry this woman, and I'll tell you why in these two cases. And we should tar and feather him for marrying her, but nevertheless, the marriage is valid. Not only is it valid, it's a kosher marriage. He may have to wait 2 years until he can consummate the marriage. And this is the case where a man marries a woman who was married before, and he didn't wait the 24 months required to wait between one marriage and the other. And that's called Muberes Chaveru Menikes Chaveru. So let's take the first case. Muberes Chaveru means that she was impregnated by her first husband.
Sorry, where did the 24 months come from?
The 24 months is going to be the minimum time it takes for her to nurse the child. So we don't want to wait. We don't want to allow her to get married. And now again, I don't know, you'll tell me the biology of it, I'm not sure, but it seems that if a woman gets pregnant while she's nursing, it can undermine her ability to nurse. That's the Gemara's assumption. Do we have any gynecologists here that could either, you know? Okay. So you'll watch them call it, you'll Google this.
If she falls pregnant again.
Correct. So if we allow her to marry a second husband, then what's going to happen is he might impregnate her, and therefore it might undermine her ability to nurse the child. So again, I think you were here, Alan, when I mentioned this, the halacha is big time in favor of nursing. You know, today we have substitutes, you know, you have what do they call it?
Formula.
What's the famous thing? I don't want to mention. Maternity, you have all this stuff. But in those days, you know, it was like nursing was like life or death. You know what I'm saying? So he violated this Isur. And he
normally
married
a woman with nursing shouldn't get pregnant, but
correct. But things do happen. You know, does happen. I know of at least one case where it happened. It's not rare. I mean, it's rare, but it's not so rare. Anyway, Muberes Chavero, so he had no right to marry this woman. But basically what we're going to tell him, this is before we get to Rabbi Meir, we're going to tell him, wait out the 24 months, and then you'll consummate the marriage. So again, it's not a case of a permanent illegitimacy of marriage, you know, where the Isur is permanent. It's a funny kind of case. It's a very rare kind of an animal here, where the Ishus is a complete Ishus, but yet he cannot consummate the Ishus. We have to tell him that on a temporary basis he has to separate himself from his wife, and he can only reactivate the marriage after 24 months. And then we have a case of Meinekes Chavero. Once again, he married a woman. She's not pregnant in this case, but she's nursing. So she's nursing a little baby. And once again, we don't allow such a marriage with a nursing baby. Now, I personally know of a case where a woman actually showed up for her wedding with a very strange kind of gown. And what we figured out later was that she was trying to hide from the rabbis that she was pregnant. In any event, a muberes or a meinekes is, as we said before, it's a temporary prohibition. He writes in the footnote here, a woman who is widowed or divorced and she was pregnant or nursing may not remarry until the child is 24 months old. Okay, fine. So now what happens in this case? So we first have Rabbi Meir's opinion. Rabbi Meir says, lo shosos v'lo not los ksuba, that for all intents and purposes, this marriage is an illegitimate marriage. Ah, you'll ask Akasha, what do you mean it's illegitimate? Just let him wait out to 24 months. So the Gemara says, "Shall your Rabbi Meir Omer lo yisa adam uberes chaver meinekes chaver v'imnasa yotzi v'lo yachzer olamis." Rabbosei, do you hear this? Yes. Rabbi Meir is so upset. Yes. He's so opposed to this marriage. He's not going to let you wait out the 24 months. He's going to force you to divorce this woman, and he's going to tell you can never remarry her. Again, if it's a Kohen, that's I understand, but I'm not a Kohen. So why can't I remarry this woman 24 months down the line? Nein, we're going to beat you to a pulp. This is called a knas, if you're familiar with that term. Kuf nun samach. We're going to penalize you, and the penalty is that we're not going to let you be married to this woman. We're going to force you to divorce this woman. This was Rabbi Meir's way of putting teeth, of guaranteeing that people wouldn't do such a thing, because he was so concerned about the woman's ability to nurse for a full term of 24 months, that he said, if you violate this and you marry this woman and you may undermine her ability to nurse, we're going to tell you have to divorce her, and we're going to force you to divorce her in a Jewish court of law, and you could never remarry her. The Chachamim Omrim, no. Chachamim say yotzi ukshagia zmano lichnos yiknos. Now there are two interpretations of these words. I'm going to give you the simple interpretation, and maybe tomorrow, which is our last meeting, I'm going to give you a more a curveball, a little different way of learning this Gemara. But the simple pshat in this Gemara, and that's apparently the way Rashi learns it, is that we will force him to divorce her, but he could remarry her after 24 months. In other words, the Chacham are not willing to go all the way like Rav Meir with this knas, this penalty, and say he can never marry her. So according to the Chachamim, we have here a temporary situation. And therefore, in this case, since it's not a permanent prohibition that separates the two, she will drink from the Meimarorin. But the main part of this discussion is the next four words. Veharovesh and Nosa Kora, Rov is a young man, Shenasa Kara Uzkena. He married a woman who's barren because she's an older woman or she had some sort of an event. V'elo Ishu Banim Meikara. He never had a wife other than this wife. He never had any children. So therefore, he's entering into a marriage which the Chachamim would certainly not encourage, because he has a mitzvah of what, everybody? If he was never married before, he has no children. Pruravu. And now he's marrying a woman with whom he cannot possibly fulfill the mitzvah of Pruravu. And therefore the Chachamim say, Lo shosa velo notelis ksubasa. She's excluded from the parsha of Meimararim, because as we said before, this is on the bottom of the previous page, it says that v'niksa v'nizra misha darkal azriya yotzezusha ein darkal azriya. Comes along Rebbe Lazar and he says, no, yachalu lisa cheres v'lifros v'libra imena. Who cares if this marriage doesn't lend itself to bearing children? But nevertheless, he doesn't have to divorce her. So the marriage is absolutely kosher. And they can live together as husband and wife for the, you know, biz Mashiach Zeit. And the only problem is, he's going to have to marry another woman. Okay, fine. Let him marry a second woman. But he doesn't have to divorce this woman who never is a barren woman. He'll fulfill his mitzvah with a second woman. And therefore, the marriage is perfectly legitimate. And therefore, she will drink from the Mei Mararin. And then the Brisa says, "Avol makane larusasol shemeres yovin shlo mishenichnasa nistera shosa velono tells ksuva." In the case of an arusa and a shemeres yovam, in these two cases, if the kinui took place while she was an arusa, but the stira took place after the nesuin, or in the case of yovam, the stira took place after he consummated the marriage with yibum, is then we'll give her a choice. Either she drinks from the Mei Mararim because of the Kenyan Stira, which is valid, or she, if she refuses to drink from the Mei Mararim, she forfeits her ksuba, he'll divorce her, she can never live with him or with the accused Boel with whom she had Stira. And that's going to be a case where the Stira took place after Erisin or after after Nisuin or after Yibum. Okay. Alright, I'm looking at the clock here and I see we're running short on time, so I'll answer all your questions now, but let me just make a little note here, if somebody could help me with this, that we're up to the case of Meuberes Umeinekes Atzmo. Can somebody make a note of that? Which is on page Chavav Amid Aleph. And it's about, I would say, 12, maybe 13, 14 lines down from the top. Yeah, questions?
Would be marrying a lady who's pregnant and the rabbis force them to do a divorce? It says nothing here about ketubah.
I think, if I'm not mistaken, that he has to pay the ketubah. What? Does anybody say he doesn't have to pay the ketubah?
There's no mention of ketubah.
I think the assumption is he'll have to pay the ketubah. I mean, he had no right to marry her, but he owes her a ketubah. I mean, the marriage is valid.
That's fine.
Let me just see if there's anything maybe here. Just 1 second. Maybe your question. I thought for sure he has to pay the ketubah. Let's just see. Just 1 second. Where are we up to here? So it could be in footnote number 1, 2, or 3. Let's see. 1. It's not. 2. It's not. And 3. It's not. I don't know. In the absence of any proof to the opposite, I think he has to pay the ksuba. I mean, he married this woman. He owes her a ksuba.
It's very strange.
Do you guys want to fight this out? I mean, don't get me involved.
I would think that it would be the option for the husband, with regard to the menekes or the pregnant woman, the nursing or the pregnant woman, that he should not have to necessarily divorce her, but simply wait.
Correct.
Until
that's
going to
be my discussion tomorrow. Mm-hmm. But the simple shot, which Rashi seems to take up, is they're not going to believe him that he's going to, you know, hang around, mm-hmm. you know what I'm saying, and not enter into her private chambers.
I understand, there should still be an option.
Okay, so that we'll discuss tomorrow, but I'm just saying right now, I was just presenting Rashi's sheet. The Rashi sheet says we're not gonna rely on him. We're going to force him to divorce her right now. He can remarry her in 2 months' time, as long as she doesn't get married to anybody else.
Okay.
No, because it could be a very good intention from him, because at that time a widow was pregnant or nursing. If she hasn't got any family, a father, brother to go back to, she would be absolutely left without nothing. So the guy who would marry her would, it's in fact a way of helping her.
He should help her.
Should help her.
At least pay the ksuba. I mean, ksuba is a good sum of money.
Yeah.
And also, you don't mind opening up this door, because I have another class. And just
one question.
Does everyone have a great day? And thank you for joining
me. One question. How come an Ilonis is allowed to marry?
She can marry someone who's not obligated in period of marriage. Either because he had another marriage, or...
She's not... Well, it's a very difficult problem, because it happens with women or with
men. But the same
men.
Situation is a woman who's barren. She cannot marry a man who's obligated in the midst of period of marriage.
Yeah, yeah.
That's a problem of a young man marrying an older woman.
Yeah, so in fact, it would be halakhically forbidden for a young man
to marry
to
an older woman.
Marry an absolutely. Old rich widow.
Absolutely. Now, in contemporary life, there's a new issue. Mm-hmm. That this woman, before she passed the menopause, she froze her eggs.
Yeah.
So is he allowed to marry her and procreate from her frozen eggs? I mean, this is something in the 21st century or the end of the 20th century. I mean, this was unknown.
No, that's
a fascinating issue.
Yeah, really.
Then the question is, if he's Mekayim Piri Virivia, not Mekayim, test tube babies and so forth and so on. I have a close friend, and the only child they had was a test tube baby, but it was her ovum and his sperm.
Yeah.
And the postkim said that he's obligated to do this, because they had no way of procreating in a regular, sexual relationship, so they did it in a test tube.
Yeah.
And he was Mekayim the Mitzvah Piri Virivia. And he left a tremendous legacy, because this son is his only child.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay then?
Okay.